We don't have any kind of arrangement in place for that, I'm afraid. Might be worth getting in touch with her directly.
We went to the waiting area and Anne dug inside her bag. Something was beginning to dawn on me, though. A bad feeling about a memory I'd had the day before. When she'd opened the door and spoken to me, I thought Anne's voice was familiar because it reminded me of my own. Now I wondered if it had reminded me of the social worker. While she scrolled through her phone, I walked slowly out of hearing, keeping my eyes on her. I found the number of the local authority, identified myself as a police officer and asked if I could speak to Sandra Allen. Failing that, her line manager. A few minutes later, I hung up and returned to my sister.
Straight to voicemail, she said.
Sandra Allen's not coming, I told her. From what I can tell, she doesn't exist. A complicated look passed between us. A lifetime of doubts in institutions. Our family, each other.
Then who did we both talk to?
Said Anne, her face falling as she came to the same conclusion I had.
Oh, fuck.
I nodded, my mind replaying the bitter conversations I'd had with the woman on the other end of the phone.
What do we do?
I looked about and then took her by the arm, guiding us outside for some fresh air. As we passed through the revolving door, Anne stopped holding up her phone. Sandra Allen calling.
Hello?
She said, picking up, holding the phone between us. There was silence, and then the voice.
It's good to see you again, said the woman at the other end.
I started to look about us, but the car park was on one side and the hospital on the other. I stepped back to look up at the windows, but it was impossible. There were hundreds of them. Anne was trying to hold it together.
What is this? I wondered if I could do something right for a change, said the woman. I wondered if I could give you back to each other.
Where are you?
You've got so pretty, said the woman. My Anne.
My sister's voice shook.
Where are you? Look after each other, said the woman. If I ask one thing, it's that.
Wait, I said, but the line went dead. Anne tried to call back, but it went straight to an automated voicemail message.
Fuck,
she whispered. We both started looking about us, through the windscreens of cars, up at the building, at the people walking in and out, but no one seemed right. I was processing a thousand different feelings at once, but one of them, I knew, was a sense of relief. She had my phone number and my address. For days I'd felt as though I was being watched or followed by an unknown set of eyes. Perhaps it had been as innocent as my mother daring herself to get back in touch after all these years. At the far side of the car park, I saw a matte black Mercedes pull out and cruise towards the exit. I started towards it, first walking, then running, sprinting, until I could almost reach out and touch it. The car turned out of the lot and merged into traffic before I could get the license plate. When I walked back to my sister, out of breath, my relief had evaporated and she knew.
You saw that car before, she said. You were watching it in the rear view,
I nodded, feeling like my real life was catching up with me.
Why would she have followed us from Manchester when she knew where we were going?
She didn't, I said, turning back to the road. That was someone else. There was just a man in the car.
Who is he?
I don't know. Never seen him before.
You look sick, Aidan. You must have some idea.
Two ambulances were approaching, the sirens growing louder, and I thought about what Zane had told me about having someone killed. Do it right, and you can walk off whistling with your hands in your pockets. I looked about us, then at Anne. How would you feel about splitting up, taking the train home? She walked back to the car and climbed in, waiting for me with her going-nowhere arms crossed. Chapter 9. So we drove all day, sometimes talking and sometimes quiet. When we lapsed into those thoughtful, hour-long silences, there was no telling how they might feel. Sometimes it was companionable, sometimes it was uncomfortable. It was easy, and at the same time difficult. There was some push and pull between us that I thought it might have been good for me to have in my life sooner. I'd had relationships over the years, but when things got serious, went too much one way or the other, I'd ghost, cut and run, disappear. There should be people in your life you can't let go of, I thought, and people who can't let go of you. Anne's adoptive mother had lived in a converted farmhouse out in the moorlands, where she'd run a small garden centre and nursery from 4 greenhouses. She'd been ill for some time, and Anne had been helping her to sell the business before she passed away. The house would become a cafe, restaurant and tea room, while the garden centre and nursery would expand. In the interim, Anne still had the keys, and had been planning to use a few days of this week to box up the remainder of their things. It seemed like the natural place to go. When we arrived on Sunday night, it was getting late, and we were both exhausted from 8 or 9 hours in the car, both badly in need of a drink after the day's events. I thought I'd taken a wrong turn as I pulled into the lane. It was a steep incline, over a mile long, cutting through woodland. There was a walled embankment on one side, and a sheer drop on the other, with a canal at the bottom. After a treacherous blind turn, we reached the top, my headlights illuminating the farmhouse, a grey brick monster that seemed to fill up our entire field of vision. Anne said that for the most part it had been just the two of them here, each enjoying their own space. There had also been the labourers who helped her mother in the garden centre, living in a segregated part of the house, renovated for the purpose. I got the sense that my sister was proud of the place, that it was important for her to show it to me, as if she was charting a part of herself on a map that I wouldn't otherwise see. We both showered and then walked down a path through the trees, following the canal for a mile or so by torchlight, to the local pub. We were still talking, still falling silent, still making life easier and more difficult for each other. The room smelt of ale, hearty food and burning logs from the fireplace. The barman recognised my sister, greeting her warmly.
"Come for one last look around, have we?"
"I'm commuting for your steak and ale pie," she said.
Nothing had ever sounded better to me, but I wouldn't be able to open my mouth wide enough to chew it. I settled for beer, burgundy red ale, and crisps. When some locals had finished their meal, we managed to get a place by the fire, where we drank quietly. I went up for another round of drinks and caught the barman looking at my jaw, wondering who I was. I tried to smile, paid for 2 pints, and returned to Anne talking to a young woman and a boyfriend, petting their dog and laughing. I stood back, not wanting to intrude. But when she saw me, she waved me over, putting her arm around my shoulder, squeezing until it hurt.
"Here he is," she said. "This is my big brother."
Chapter 10. We spent most of the next day packing. At around lunchtime, I drove us into town, where Anne borrowed a dilapidated old transit van from the couple she'd spoken to in the pub. It didn't look fit to sit in, let alone drive, and as I followed her back along the lane to her mother's house, I wondered how it would handle the incline of the path. I kept my distance, breathing a sigh of relief as she made the final blind turn to the house. The rest of the day was spent working through the possessions that were left inside. Mainly books, bric-a-brac, the pictures from the walls. As we worked, Anne expanded on what I knew of her childhood and the major players of her young life. Her adoptive mother had been married when she first arrived, but the husband had been a sickly man and died 2 years later. She'd never really known him. Didn't think of him as a father, which meant her chief male influence had been the labourers working in the nursery. She attributed her being a tomboy to this, but I thought she'd always been that way. Boisterous and knockabout, fascinated by how things fit together, or better yet, how they came apart. Once she'd parked the van, she'd been straight onto the engine, checking oils and fluids, getting her hands dirty in a way I wouldn't dream of unless I was stranded on the roadside. She'd worked away happily for a few minutes before looking up. She saw me watching her and winked. Moving into the last room, taking the books down from the cases, I came upon a battered copy of Crime and Punishment. I turned it over, flicking through to see notes made in pencil.
No, no, don't read those, said Anne,
looking over my shoulder. Did you like it?
Something you'll learn about me, she laughed. I love my Russians. Have you read it?
I shook my head.
You can have this one. Just let me rub out the notes.
A friend gave me a copy recently, I said. I thought of Adam, hanged inside his cell. He got away from the prison guards, away from the dealers and Zane Carver. But you can't ever get away from yourself. I wondered if that's what I was trying to do in coming here, moving to a slightly bigger cell for a few days before the inevitable.
I'll probably read that. It's sitting on a shelf at home.
It's actually where I've put your letter. It's pressed right in the middle. She smiled, and her eyes went to the window, where a streak of pink light cut through the clouds on the horizon. It was starting to get dark. Do you fancy a drink tonight?
I'd probably rather get this last bit done, but a beer wouldn't go amiss. They'll sell you some if you fancy the walk.
I agreed to go, looking forward to the walk, the whiskey I'd drink at the bar, and the bottles clinking in the bag on my way back. Best of all, drinking them with her. I took my coat, followed the path down to the canal, and was at the pub within 15 minutes. The barman served me with less reservation than the day before, happily bagging up some bottles for us, but he still watched me closely.
She's golden, that girl. We'll miss her around here. And her mum, of course.
I nodded my agreement, and he went on.
You any relation?
Just a friend. Just helping her pack. He nodded.
Looks nasty, that jaw.
It can be, I said, trying a smile. He paused as he handed me my change, leaning in confidentially.
I had a bloke in, asking about you last night. After you went.
What?
Big guy, red in the face, but sort of quiet-spoken. Asked if I knew that beat-up bloke who'd been in earlier with Annie. He used her name, I said.
The barman nodded.
Did he say who he was?
Said he was a friend of hers too. He looked at me significantly.
Only, he didn't look like anyone's friend to me.
I walked out onto the street looking for the matte black Mercedes, but couldn't see anything or anyone. Then I started back for the house, trying to resist the urge to call ahead. After a couple of minutes, I found myself dialing anyway, getting my sister's voicemail. I hung up and sent a text instead, keeping it light. On my way. All good? She didn't respond, and when I got back to the house, I went straight into the study where I'd left her. She wasn't there, and I called out her name, hearing my voice echo back to me. I started to go room by room, ripping doors open, ignoring the ringing in my ears, until I came to the kitchen, where I found her standing at the sink. She jumped as I burst into the room, putting her hand to her chest.
Shit, she said, trying to read the look on my face. Are you all right?
I nodded, feeling the pins and needles tickling through my legs. She looked at my empty hands.
Where's the beer?
Chapter 11. I waited an hour after Anne had gone to bed, and then got up as quietly as I could. I descended the stairs carefully, trying not to make any sound, and took a bottle of scotch from one of the packed boxes. Then I went to the front door and stepped out into the night. There were no lights outside, none for miles around, and I let my eyes adjust to the dark over a few minutes. Once they had, I walked around the house properly, the disused stables and greenhouses, then back to the front door again, seeing and hearing nothing out of the ordinary. I went to my car, parked beside the van, and climbed in. The air was so cold that my lungs ached, and I used the scotch to stay warm, watching the mouth of the driveway until I saw a hue of light in the sky, the false dawn. Then I went back inside the house and slept for a couple of hours. I woke when I heard her moving about, joining her downstairs in the kitchen. She was making coffee, and turned to me with both hands wrapped round a mug. I thought I heard you leaving last night, she said.
Just checking a few things.
You were out there a long time. Still sleeping in the back seat?
Something like that.
She angled her head. I thought you might be running out on me. She handed me the mug, and I tried to look dependable, like the thought hadn't crossed my mind.
Chapter 12
Once the van was fully loaded and the house was locked up, we looked at each other.
I feel like I should probably drive that thing, I said, nodding at the transit.
She was amused. It'll be like steering a cruise ship going down that bank.
It could be my next career.
I've done it 1,000 times, but I'm keen to see you try.
She was half laughing at me.
Do you want to follow?
She nodded, and I climbed into the van, adjusting the seat and then the mirrors.
I caught a glimpse of her doing the same thing in my car, and had a sudden flash of paranoia. It was my car that this man had followed from the city, my car that he'd been watching if he found us again. I climbed out of the van and went to her before she could start up.
Change of plan, I said, opening the driver's side door. You're right, I'm being stupid.
I handed her the keys and she shrugged. Wimp. She got out, went to the van and started up. The engine didn't take first time, but on the second it roared, and a thick plume of smoke spluttered out of the exhaust. She pulled cautiously towards the mouth of the driveway, cresting the hill that would take us down to the main road. I saw her brake lights come on before she went out of view and I followed. Once I'd crested the hill myself, I saw that she was moving fast, even though her brake lights were still on. I tried my own to no effect as she approached the blind turn. They'd been cut. I saw the van waver left towards the walled embankment before veering abruptly to the right, cutting through the trees. It dropped out of view like it had ceased to exist. There was silence. Then the sound of bark breaking, 3 loud bangs in quick succession. 3.5 tons of steel rolling down a hill. There was a gap, and then a bone-shaking crash as it hit the bottom. She'd swerved to avoid a matte black Mercedes parked across the road. I pulled up the handbrake and skidded to a stop, 5 feet from it, breathing hard. I was ripping off my seatbelt when a man emerged from the car, pointing a gun at me. He was big, red-faced and bald. I agreed with the barman. He didn't look like anyone's friend. I held my hands up where he could see them, watching him close the driver's side door and start towards me. He steps between the cars, and I went for the handbrake, dropping it and pressing my full weight onto the gas. I slammed forward, catching him by surprise, crushing him against the murk. His upper body was thrown forward so he was lying across my bonnet, looking right at me in astonishment, and the gun dropped from his hand. I cut the engine and climbed out. When I did, he grasped for his weapon again, but I took hold of his hand, digging my fingers into his knuckles, feeling them break apart. 2 shots went off into the sky before I ripped the gun free and threw it out of reach.
Who the fuck are you? I said, forgetting my jaw.
He watched me dispassionately, the color draining from his face.
Come and trip it as you go. On the light, fantastic toe.
He reached into a jacket pocket, and I hit him in the nose with the heel of my hand, pulling his phone away from him. He looked down at his legs, crushed between the 2 cars.
I need help.
Tell me something first, I said, holding up the phone.
Fuck you.
Good luck rolling yourself around on a skateboard, I said, turning to leave.
Wait. He panted. What do you want to know? Did you kill Tessa Klein?
He looked amused, like I couldn't have been more wrong.
You were the man at St. Mary's, I said.
But I could hear the doubt in my own voice.
You killed Yankovsky.
At first, I thought he was being sick, but instead he was wheezing, laughing silently. A revolting, sick-making sight.
You really haven't got a clue, have you?
A clue about what? A mouthful of blood burst from his lips, dripping down his chin. When he smiled at me, his teeth were stained red.
"No," he said, "I didn't kill Klein, and I've never even been to St. Mary's."
His head weaved, and his voice was growing faint.
"Then who was it?"
I was shaking his shoulder.
"I know it wasn't Carver. Tell me who, and I can help you."
A faraway look came into his eyes, and he smiled again, shaking his head.
"You can't help anyone anymore, pal. I'd sooner be me than you."
I turned and started towards the trees.
"The phone," he screamed.
"Get fucked," I said, dropping it in the road without turning round. Reaching the edge, I almost fell to my knees, looking at the path of destruction the van had left. I hoped it had collided with a tree or rock to break its fall, but I couldn't even see where it had landed. The woods were unnervingly quiet, and I slid down through the broken foliage, grasping the exposed roots of trees to steady myself. I reached a 10-foot drop at the bottom and saw the van had rolled into the canal, upside down at a 30-degree angle. The cab, the entire front end, was completely submerged, while the back, the rear doors and most of the undercarriage was visible above water. I tried to scramble down but slipped, tumbling over, landing hard. All I could hear was the water lapping, my own jagged breaths. I ripped off my shoes, pulled off my jacket and threw myself into the water. It was freezing cold, difficult to see underneath it, and when I surfaced, I had to rub the grit out of my eyes. I moved round to the driver's side door, took a breath and tried to look through the window. Making a visor of my hands, I could see Anne, hanging limply, upside down, the water inside the cab rising around her. I got my hand on the door and pulled repeatedly, but the water pressure was too great. I surfaced again, trying to breathe, moving around to the passenger side. Here, the canal wall meant there wasn't enough space to open the door, even if the water pressure allowed it. I pulled myself out onto the bank, not knowing what to do, searching through the debris from the van's fall for something hard I could break a window with. I settled on a tough-looking tree stump and went back into the water, half jumping, half falling. With the van upside down, the windscreen itself was at the bottom, completely inaccessible. There was just enough room to beat against the glass on the driver's side window, but not enough to arc or get any kind of real swing. The stump moved, uselessly, in slow motion through the water. I let it go, pressing myself between the canal wall and the van, kicking both legs into the driver's side window as hard as I could. I kept on kicking until I had to surface for air, then dived down again, using my hands as a visor against the glass. I could see a single crack, and my focus shifted to Anne inside the cab. She was conscious now, pressing both hands into the glass. She'd undone her seatbelt and was crouching on the van ceiling, trying to keep her head above the rising water. I held my finger up to signal that I'd be back in 1 minute and climbed out, looking at the vehicle. Its angle meant that the back doors were above water, but raised up in the air, out of reach. If my lungs or my jaw would have allowed it, I would have screamed into the sky. I dropped back into the canal, gasping now, moving to the front of the van and lifting myself out of the water, onto the exposed undercarriage. From there, I crawled up, gripping the exhaust pipe that ran down its center. I went carefully, feeling the effect of my weight. The back end of the van was tilting even deeper down. If the rear doors were submerged, then the water pressure would keep them forced shut, killing my sister. Gripping the end of the van, I flattened myself to the undercarriage, reaching over the edge. I got my fingers to the handle and pulled. The doors were locked. I went limp then, climbing carelessly back down into the water. When I got out onto the bank again, I was heavy and flat, panting, looking left and right, up at the sky. The ringing in my ears was so loud I almost didn't hear my phone going off in my jacket pocket on the floor. I crawled towards it, dug inside and answered.
"I can't get out," said Anne.
"No." I was so out of breath that it hurt to talk. "I need to go and get help.
It's coming up too fast. It's at my head already."
She was out of breath too, and I could hear her teeth chattering.
"Please don't go," she said.
But there were sunspots creeping in the corners of my vision, and I threw the phone down on the floor, backed away from it, fighting off another panic attack. I went to my knees, trying to think. No passerby could get her out. No fire engine could get here in time. I thought about the lockpick set in the boot of my car, but knew I couldn't climb back up the hill, that following the path back to the house would take 10 minutes, even if I threw myself back down. That would be 10 minutes too long. I could see sunspots everywhere now, feel my chest wrenching itself shut. And I hit myself in the head as hard as I could, trying to stay alert. Collapsing beside my discarded jacket, I began searching through it for anything I could use, throwing things onto the ground. I found my own keys, pulled them off the chain and then bent the circular metal ring so it was almost straight. I could hear Anne still talking on the phone, but I went back to the water and rolled in, returning to the front of the van, lifting myself onto the undercarriage and climbing to the rear doors. Reaching over the edge, I touched the metal to the lock. It was too thick, and I just lay there, hanging uselessly from the van. I looked at my phone back on the bank. The cold, combined with the swelling in my jaw, meant that I wouldn't be able to speak anyway. I put a hand to my mouth, just wanting to rip the wire out altogether, to be able to say what I had to, at least. Shaking, I put my fingers into my mouth and felt the metal sewn into my jaw. It was taut and thin, and I looked down at the lock again. I wrapped my fingers round the wire, giving it an experimental tug. Feeling it strain against my skull, I took a breath, braced myself, and pulled as hard as I dared, feeling the metal bite into my fingers. It felt like I was pulling the teeth out of my head. I still had the keychain I'd tried to pick the lock with. I put it to my mouth, wrapped it around the wire, and pulled, releasing a violent red pain into my head. Pushing through it, pulling harder, I felt a pop, the wire breaking away from my gums. When I pulled again, I felt my back teeth shifting, my mouth ripping open, and I dug my free hand into the undercarriage, crying, shouting, screaming out. Hot, wet blood rolled down my chin, and I could taste it and smell it and feel it on my fingers. 1, 2, 3, pull! 1, 2, 3, pull! Everything went static white, and I beat my fist against the undercarriage to stay conscious. When my vision started to clear again, I saw that I was holding the wire in trembling, blood-soaked hands. It was glistening red, and I wiped it onto my clothes, snapping it in two before leaning over the edge again and reaching down to the rear doors. I put the wire to the lock on the back door and started to pick. It was a pin and tumbler, like every car I'd broken into as a little boy. It felt like all the luck in the world combined. I inserted one end of the wire bent upwards, a makeshift torsion wrench, and used the other to brush the brass pins inside it, pushing them upwards. As I worked, I felt the van moving beneath me, its back end sliding deeper into the water. I held my breath, trying to stay calm, and kept working until I heard a click. Then, very carefully, I took hold of the handle and pulled. The door opened. In the same moment, the van leveled out, throwing me into the canal again, causing water to rush in through the rear doors. The back was packed with boxes, most filled with books, and I started pulling them out with both hands, throwing them over my shoulder, pushing them clear of the doorway, desperately making a path towards the cab. When I pulled the last layer away, I saw Anne, holding her mouth up to the 2 or 3 inches of air pocket that remained. There was a metal grill between us, and moving the boxes had allowed the water to flood through, almost submerging us both. I took a breath, pulled against the grill with all my weight. It didn't move the first time, and I pulled again. Looked at my sister. She had both hands on it too. We counted together, nodding our heads. One pushing, one pulling. We kept on going, counting in threes, our fingers bursting against the steel. We were both underwater now. When one corner bolt broke, I moved, concentrating my efforts, tearing it from the fixture and sliding the grill aside. Anne had gone limp, and I reached into the cab and took hold of her, pulling her through the small gap. We clawed through the back of the van and broke the surface, both panting, gasping for air, lungs screaming for breath. We went to the bank arm in arm, but I couldn't climb out. My fingers and hands and mouth were bleeding, and I was shaking, crying, shivering, swearing. Anne pulled herself up first, and then helped me after her. We lay there a few minutes, holding on to each other, and I muttered every swear word that came into my head, again and again, trying to get it all out and get warm, trying to prove we were still alive. There were two deep handprints in Anne's arm from where I'd pulled her through the van. Minutes passed before we looked at each other properly. When her eyes came onto mine, I said, "Give me as long as you can before you call the police." She was still shaking, out of breath.
"Where are you going?"
I climbed to my feet and started to gather my things from the grass, putting my keys loose into my jacket pocket, collecting my phone, stepping into my shoes. My fingers were shredded from the wire, the grill, and my jaw was hanging loose.
"You're not coming back," she said, getting up. "Are you?"
I didn't say anything, and her fists clenched by her side. For a moment, I thought she might hit me. Instead, she hugged me as hard as she could, pressing her body into mine. I could feel her heart beating through the soaked folds in her jacket. I looked over her shoulder and spoke into her ear.
"You weren't a mistake," I said. "You can't be. Meeting you again was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life."
We broke apart, and she turned away, muttering something with her hands in front of her face. When I touched her arm, she repeated it, looking at me with raw eyes.
"I said you're talking like your life's over."
Part 9. Push the Sky Away. Chapter 1.
I walked back along the canal and took the path up to the house, going inside for painkillers, washing them down with the scotch and taking the bottle. Walking back down the drive, there was nothing that could have surprised me, but I took the blind turn cautiously. The man was where I left him, bled white, plainly dead, and I'd been afraid of doing time for passport fraud. I collected the phone from the road and unlocked it with the dead man's cold, wet thumb. It was a burner. Nothing saved in the photos, notes or contacts. But I found one message from an unsaved number. "Confirm when in position." I looked at the man, crushed between two cars, slumped over onto the hood of mine, and tapped out a reply. "In position." Then I wiped down the phone and put it back in his pocket. I took his keys and began maneuvering his car out of its sideways position, turning it towards the main road. The man dropped like a sack onto the ground, and when I adjusted the rearview mirror, I caught a glimpse of the horror show I was leaving behind me. A car covered in blood, the debris of trees, and a person almost cut in half. I climbed out of the murk, collecting the gun from the ground, then got back in and drove. I was halfway back to the city when my phone rang. My fingers were too ruined with intersecting gashes and cuts to pick up while driving, so I pulled over and answered in a lay-by.
"Aiden, where are you?"
"Naomi," I slurred, wincing at the way my jaw felt, the sound coming out of it. I took the pills from the passenger seat and swallowed a handful, washing them down with the scotch. She heard the bottle. You're supposed to be in the hospital.
I feel better, I said.
Not if your girlfriend hit you as hard as she did me.
Yankovsky was never my girlfriend.
I know, friends with benefits.
Not friends and no benefits. I lied to you. She was blackmailing me.
Naomi fell silent, but her curiosity won out.
What did she want?
She wanted me to suppress evidence against her. The phone with her number on it.
So why didn't you?
I thought it might get Esther killed.
Neither of us spoke for a moment, and I spent the time massaging my jaw.
I can't tell if I hate you more or less for that, she said finally.
Well, think on it.
You won't tell me where you are?
I didn't say anything.
Should I be worried?
Not about me.
Should I pretend I didn't hear that?
I grunted in agreement.
Then you do me a favour.
If you want a reference,
I want you to talk to Frank Moore.
I looked into the mirror. I could probably draw a crowd in a freak show.
Might be difficult, I said.
A phone call, that's all I ask. He wants to talk to you.
I'm beyond the survival seminar. What does he want?
He won't tell me.
Dickhead, I said.
Meaning?
He has some kind of problem with women. Would never look you in the eye. Always directed answers to me. When he bothered giving them at all. You didn't notice?
I don't pay attention to shit like that.
You better start. She laughed.
Now you're giving me advice.
I might not get another chance.
It should have been different between us, she said.
I wanted to say something in return. The same thing, but more. Instead, I heard myself changing the subject.
I've got time to kill. Put him through, I'm game.
You'll tell me what he says?
You've got it.
And is there anything I can do?
Look after yourself, I said.
Same to you, hot stuff.
I ended the call and sat waiting for Frank, tapping out my anxiety and drinking the scotch from my jaw. Naomi was right when she said that things should have been different between us.
So why couldn't I just say it back?
Why did everything worth saying have to be crowbarred out of me? The call came through 10 minutes later.
Wait, said Frank,
as an automated message from the holding facility warned us this conversation may be recorded.
How's it going? I said.
If you feel like being flippant...
Listen, Frank. Since your arrest, I've had my jaw broken, wired shut, and then broken again. It literally hurts to tell you this. So could you cut to the fucking chase?
I've been thinking about Briar's Green. The night Maggie and the kids died.
It's about time.
I was drunk that night.
Blackout drunk.
I'm not calling to confess, he said. I woke up in the last place I remember sitting down, in Rebecca's flat, pants round my ankles.
Well, thanks for the information.
Listen, he growled. With everything that came after, I was grateful to her. She was so steadfast in her alibi for me that I believed it myself. I know for a fact I didn't get out of that chair, I couldn't even walk. So I didn't feel bad about her saying we were together all night. I've just been wondering if...
I could hear him breathing into the phone.
If? I've been wondering if she knew how grateful I'd be. How much I'd need her to cover for me. I'm wondering if she tricked me into being her alibi.
Jesus Christ, Frank.
He didn't say anything.
Was she jealous of Maggie?
She hated her. And I...
You told her you wanted to go back to your family.
Something like that.
You need to call Naomi Black and put all this on the table now.
I'd rather you and I'm not with the police anymore, Frank. Just like Blake, eh?
I told you. This case kills everything it touches. Unless you want to add your kids' names to that list again, You'll get over your shit and call Naomi. She's the only one who can help you now.
I will, he said. Then he laughed.
I really believed it all. You know, I thought I was helping people.
It sounds like you've believed a lot of things. Yeah, he said, considering the statement. I'd still rather be like that than be like you, though. I mean, what do you believe in?
The question surprised me, and I tried to think of an answer. Before I could respond, I heard the pips go at the other end. I'll see you round, he said, hanging up, leaving me with the dial tone.
Chapter 2. I waited until the manager and hostess had exited the Light Fantastic, locked up and left, before I started the Mercedes, my eyes on that solitary lit window on the first floor. I put my foot down and drove right at the main entrance, crashing through the double glass doors and into the empty club, ploughing through tables and chairs, slamming into the bar. I left the engine running and climbed out of the car. There was an alarm going off, and I could feel glass crunching beneath my shoes. I found the door leading back of house, followed the corridor to the steel spiral staircase. I climbed up, went to Carver's office and kicked open the door. He was standing beside the desk, pouring out two large tumblers of Hennessy. He slid one forward slightly before looking up. Perhaps he'd been expecting me, but I could see that he was surprised by the gun, and he frowned slightly as he took in the damage to my hands, arms and face, to my life. I smiled at him. He smiled back.
I'd say you should get that looked at, he said, but I'm not sure anyone could stomach it.
I went to the desk and picked up the tumbler he'd pushed towards me, holding it up for a toast. He lifted his own, touched it to mine, and took a drink. I backhanded him with the gun, breaking the glass into his face, and he crashed down onto the floor. When he looked up at me, his lips were blood red.
Sorry, I said. Let me get you another.
I picked up the bottle and poured the contents over his head, holding the gun on him. He sat there and took it, smiling once I was finished, and I dropped the bottle into his lap.
Got a cigarette? He said.
We both laughed, and I sat on the corner of his desk, looking down at him. There was a sound at the door, and two large men appeared. Carver shook his head at them.
Get the alarm, will you?
One of the men backed uncertainly out of the room, while the other one watched me. Carver gave his full attention from the floor, sitting up against the wall, waiting for the alarm to cut out. Once it did, I could hear myself breathing.
So what do I owe the pleasure? He said. Your man just tried to kill me. He almost killed my sister.
He wiped cognac out of his eyes.
That's troubling. That he didn't get it done. That he jumped the gun. You know my policy. Maybe he was just better informed than you are.
Oh?
I'm a free agent now.
The man at the door took a step towards me, and I re-gripped the gun, pointing it at Carver's head, feeling like I could finally do it.
I hadn't heard, he said. Either way, it's no excuse for what happened.
He sounded like a hotel receptionist, telling me that my room had been given away to someone else.
Let me try and make it up to you.
Call off the hit, I said.
You know I can't do that, and shooting me won't help. It's out there. It's too late.
A smirk came to his face.
Maybe you should try and get your job back.
I thought about the deal between Pars and Chase, covering up a young woman's death, and more besides, for the sake of their careers. I shook my head.
This thing with your sister, said Carver, climbing to his feet, wringing the cognac out of his designer suit. That's regrettable. I can promise you nothing like that happens from here on in. I'm a family man myself now.
So I keep hearing, I said. After this morning, there were two places I could go, Zane.
Here, or Fairview. I've got enough bullets for your wife and kid. He darkened. That a threat? An alternate reality. I came here instead.
The adrenaline was making my hands shake, and I took a step back so he couldn't reach me. Glancing at the man in the doorway, my vision was just a set of images, as if the office was strobe lit.
Make it worth my while, I said.
Best I can do is make some calls. Say you're still technically a cop until the end of the week. Give you a few days, at least. He began pouring himself a new drink, then looked up again, like he was surprised I was still there. Take it or leave it. Chapter 3 I left the car embedded in the Light Fantastic, the gun on the floor beside it, and walked back in the direction of my street. I needed to collect the bag, the cash, and the passport before leaving. The night seemed more high watt than usual. Eyes, lights, smiles beaming. And I felt the charge all around, making me glow along with it. Crossing Piccadilly, people moved out of my way. They looked at my face, the bags under my eyes and the beard of blood I was wearing. My clothes, rotten with canal water and drink. My shredded sleeves, fingers and hands. I passed men who might have been my friends, and women I could have loved, all going wide-eyed with simple humanity. I spun round, walking backwards, looking at them, and liking them for it, wondering if they'd remember me. Somehow, I felt like I was receiving the signal again. Something I thought I'd wandered out of range from was broadcasting to me now, loud and clear. It wasn't a mistake. Not panicking or sleepwalking anymore. And it felt like a miracle to be alive. I jogged towards my building, laughing at nothing. There were no cars outside, no lights on inside, and I ran up the stairs towards a new life, pulling the stepladder down from the wall, dragging it to my room. Once inside, I kicked the door closed behind me, leaving the light off. I stood the ladder in what I thought was the right position, and floated to the top, moving the loose fitting, reaching inside. Then there was a click and the light came on.
"Looking for this?" said a man.
I turned to see my new neighbour, Robbie, sitting beside the door, holding a gun on me. The bag was at his feet.
"Why don't you come down from there, eh?"
I heard the ladder fall, and suddenly I was sitting on the floor, looking up at him.
"You killed Tessa Klein," I said, uselessly.
He reached into his pocket and removed the envelope that I'd addressed to Charlie Sloane. He handed it to me, and then motioned me to the bathroom. I struggled to my feet, holding the envelope against my chest as if it still mattered. Robbie sniffed.
"In the toilet, I think."
I opened the envelope and held the three teeth I'd saved in the palm of my hand.
"Wrap them in some tissue," he said.
I did it automatically and dropped them into the toilet, the letter after them. Then he leaned over, pulling the flush, and we watched it all go down the drain. He walked back out into the living room, and at length, I followed.
"You killed Jankowski too," I said.
Robbie tapped the gun against his head and smiled.
"You couldn't let her kill me because you wouldn't get paid. I had to protect my investment." "How long have you been with me?" "I've been keeping an eye out for a while, but the price got so high it seemed worth moving in. I'm glad I did. You might have died otherwise. And we wouldn't want that." "Hey, I did right by you," he said. "Gave you a few days with your sister, didn't I?"
I nodded. "You must have had someone watching us."
"Course."
The way he shrugged implied he didn't know what had happened to his friend.
"What's all this about?" he said, motioning to my face. "You saw the state I was in at St. Mary's."
He nodded. I left before they stitched me up properly. Everything just fell apart.
I know, pal, I know. So let's start making sense of it all, eh? I've got something I'd like you to write.
I held out my shredded fingers. I hope it's short.
Very, he said, pointing me to my desk.
I was feeling dizzy and had to lean on it to stay upright. There was a suicide note typed out beside one of my notebooks.
I'd rather not. If it's all the same to you. I just spoke to Carver. We've come to an arrangement. He's given me a few days.
He smiled.
I'm afraid that's not what he told me.
He searched inside his pockets, producing a pair of pliers.
Sorry. Here we go.
He pulled out the envelope that had been behind them, dropping it onto the table.
What's this?
Open it. I tore it and found pictures of my sister. Some of them showed her in the city, with friends, or at home. There were even some long lens shots from her mother's house in the moorlands.
Like I said, I've got a guy there.
What if I don't believe you? He smiled, took out his phone and scrolled to a number. When he handed it to me, I saw that it was a landline. The house in the moorlands, I assumed. I hit call and waited until the phone was answered.
Hello? Said Anne.
Who's that? I said, as though I was talking to someone else.
Aidan? Is that you?
I see, I said quietly. I hung up and handed back the phone. Then I began copying down the suicide note. I still had the one I'd abandoned before, when I couldn't think of anyone to address it to. It just said, Dear, at the top of the page, and I wrote my sister's name after it. My hands were shaking quite badly now, but I wondered if that made it all worthwhile.
What happened to Tessa Klein? I said, once I'd finished.
Professional curiosity.
When I twisted round, Robbie was much closer to me than I remembered, and I wondered how he'd moved so quietly.
She went and got pregnant on him, broke his heart.
I bet. So what did you do with her?
I'll show you, he said, if you're that curious. But it's a one-way trip. You've got to really want to know.
I initialed the note and stood.
I think I do.
Robbie opened the door and walked out onto the landing, holding the gun on me from inside his coat pocket. I followed him, paused in the doorway and looked back. When I touched the frame, I got a static shock, and in a flash, I saw it all. The violent neon ghosts of my past and all the hearts I'd slammed shut on my way out. Exposed foundations and endless regeneration cranes filling the skylines, the people beneath them, crashing into each other like wrecking balls, half cut, half formed, half finished. The sad, mismatched hospital furniture and the homeless men, weaving through traffic, wearing their sleeping bags like capes. Little boys letting their eyes adjust in the dark, their life savings hidden in their socks. My little sister in the back seat, and a Muzak version of My Heart Will Go On. Career politicians, failing upwards, always just out of spitting distance, and all the good men with black holes where their eyes should be. Carbon footprints, panic rooms, charismatic racists and gifted liars, salesmen, businessmen, salarymen, all the good men with black holes where their heart should be. All the sticks of lipstick smeared into the collars. Apocalyptic weather reports and the birds chirping, singing, screaming in the trees. And then I could hear myself breathing. Hear myself think. I could see my hand, unrecognizable with cuts and bruises, gripping the doorframe. When I let go, it felt like the easiest thing in the world. I turned, threw my arms around Robbie, and launched us both over the banister. Part 10. Let's stop here. Chapter 1.
Physician, fuck thyself, Sutty grumbled, pulling onto Oxford Road.
It was his first day back on active duty, and he'd insisted on driving, insisted on sharing every thought that went through his head. The night shift had passed without incident. It was 6 a.m, and they were rewarded with a spectral pink dawn, turning the city from one thing into another.
"Can you drop me somewhere around Piccadilly?" said Naomi, changing the subject.
Sutty glanced over at the girl. The woman, as she'd insisted he call her. She was buried somewhere inside a brand new black parka jacket, with one knee up against the dash, reading the story about Chase's promotion to the role of chief constable. Sutty had read it earlier, noting that Alistair Pars would step in the vacant position of chief superintendent. He'd given it a second's thought. Naomi ripped the page out and screwed it up. She seemed preoccupied all night, but Sutty didn't ask why. Better to watch, wait, and work it out for himself. When he pulled onto Portland Street, and she opened the door to get out, he turned.
Same time tomorrow.
It's a date, Suts. She climbed out without looking back, hands in her pockets against the morning chill. And he watched her for a minute, walking in the direction of the northern quarter. Sutty nodded to himself. Mystery solved. Naomi couldn't explain why exactly she kept coming back. Sometimes it was a good feeling, and sometimes it was a bad one. But it never came to much. She turned onto Aidan's Road, and was surprised to see the light on inside his flat. She stood there for a moment, and then laughed, crossing the road and pressing the intercom. A moment passed, and she was buzzed inside, walking through the small hallway and up the stairs. The door was ajar, and when she pushed it open, she saw packing materials, boxes and bin bags.
"You should have told me," she said. "I'd have helped."
Anne turned to see her and smiled.
"I have had a lot of practice lately, and I thought it might be a chance to feel close to him. What brings you here?"
"Sometimes I just find myself walking by," said Naomi, going to the kitchenette.
"I hope you haven't packed the kettle. Help yourself."
Naomi found two mugs and busied herself with the tea, talking about her first shift with Sutty. She concluded the story to no answer and turned to check Anne was okay. Aidan's sister was standing at the bookcase, her back to the room. Naomi gave her a minute and then went over, touched her shoulder and handed her a cup of tea.
"Everything okay?"
Anne accepted the drink with one hand. The other was resting on the bookcase, shaking, and she was frowning, confused. The shelf was packed full, except for this one spot between Charles Dickens and Jeff Dyer, where it looked like a book the size of a house brick had been removed. Naomi tried to read the complicated expression on Anne's face, and was surprised to see her breaking into a smile. Then she looked from Aidan's sister to the shelf, trying to sound casual and keep it light.
"Are you missing something?"
We hope you've enjoyed this Penguin Audio production of The Sleepwalker by Joseph Knox, read by Lewis Taylor. It was produced by Jack Beatty, and the post-production was by Elliot Smith. For more Penguin Audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Thanks for listening. Copyright and recording, Penguin Audio 2019. Text copyright, Joseph Knox, 2019. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.